This is Sierra Dahl with Municipal Sustainability and Energy Forum, and today's conversation is going to be centered around microgrids, and we're also be discussing somewhat of what's going on with microgrids in Puerto Rico. So our first presenter is Baird Brown, talking a little bit about what's happening in Hawaii. Baird, why don't you go ahead and start us up?
Sure. So Hawaii enacted about a year and a half ago now, Act 200, which requires the Public Utility Commission to adopt a microgrid tariff and says that anybody can have a microgrid basically says you've got to set up the standardized ways for interconnection and hopefully this will lead to increased resilience. Hawaii is probably got the largest penetration of rooftop solar that isn't microgrids. You know, it doesn't have battery storage, isn't able to island and keep going. Some days, as I understand it, they hit 70% penetration. And then the rest but 80-some percent of their electricity comes from fossil fuel because there are no kind of local, and a lot of that is bunker oil, basically, a little bit of coal. So there's sort of two goals here, obviously. One is renewable energy, and the other is for which they have aggressive targets. And the other is resilience, and the problem is that the existing microgrids in Hawaii are mostly microgrids done with the utilities collaboration, and they consist of solar and some storage and a lot of diesel generators in case things don't go well. We just had a session yesterday afternoon, a working group report to the commission on the draft tariff as it stands after several months now of work on it. I think the important things about the tariff are that it first divides the world into customer microgrids and hybrid microgrids. Customer microgrids are ones which don't involve any utility infrastructure behind the point of common coupling, and hybrid ones are ones that do involve utility infrastructure. On the customer side, what we've done is tried to basically make it a framework tariff, just saying everybody can do this, and you're eligible for all the other kinds of tariffs for DER and demand response and other markets that they're actively trying to develop, like frequency response in Hawaii. I think that is going to work pretty well. We're still ironing out some details. There were some things in the interconnection rules that might have that basically said the electric company can tell you when to island, which wasn't going to work. I mean, it was sort of like asking for services without paying for them. But I think we're working through that based on yesterday's meeting. And the other thing is the hybrid microgrid, and this is something that Craig's been working a lot on in California, but the Hawaii version of it, what's in the tariff, is basically a microgrid in which everybody is still the utility's customer all of the time, really, even in island mode. And all the electricity that's produced behind the point of common coupling is sold in effect to the utility and then resold to all the customers. So there's no energy savings for the customers from installing things, except the ones that have it on their own roof. And then there's sort of a disconnect, which is solvable but not solved in the tariff, which is the people who, you might have a lot of people with individual solar or solar and storage behind the point of common coupling, and all of a sudden, if there's an emergency and you want to go into island mode, somebody has to operate who has not been operating previously, which is, you know, sort of a practical impossibility from my point of view. But if, and this is permitted under the other Hawaii tariffs, if the developer operator of the microgrid also acts as the aggregator for all of the for sales to the utility for all the generation that's behind the meter, whether they directly control it or whether it's on individual customers' rooftops, then I think there's at least a workable plan going forward. And I guess I'm waiting to see whether people get excited about that or not. There's a separate effort going on in Hawaii to determine what, and it hasn't really been dealt with in this tariff proceeding, unlike California, where it's at least front and center conceptually, what to do about critical facilities and whether there should be a tariff that pays microgrids that serve critical facilities just to be microgrids. I guess that we're waiting to see if that goes somewhere in the separate proceeding. While I had the floor, I thought I'd mention one other thing that I think would be of interest to the group, and that is we've drafted legislation in Delaware, which is, you know, in the legislative hopper and moving forward, and some of the communities are already excited about it, that would permit any city or town or county to create its own municipal authority with the ability to sponsor projects and of any, you know, whether that's community solar or microgrids or, you know, sort of a, act as a convener for projects in their communities, and either contract with third parties or lots of ways that those could be organized. We tried not to limit things. And it's not like a CCA in that there's a, you know, that everybody's in unless they opt out, but there is going to be a special track in the renewable portfolio standard for community solar, defined as solar projects organized by one of these entities, which will get a, you know, an extra, you know, special set-aside tranche and presumably a higher price for SREC. So we're kind of excited about that and think that's a model that might well be useful in other parts of the country. And with that, I'll hand it on.
All right. Ron is trying to enter the call and having trouble for some reason, so I'll have to call him back and see what's going on. But he is making an attempt. I don't think you're on the call yet, Ron, are you, Ron Leonard? No. Okay. So, Craig, do you have anything to add to that? I'm sure you do.
Well, the question is, how long do you want me to talk?
Yeah, I left you California.
Yes. Yeah, that was a dumb question, wasn't it?
I'll be, you know, pointed on my comments. I do want to just you know, give people the background of the Clean Coalition. I'll take 30 seconds, because if you know what the Clean Coalition is all about, then you'll understand the rest of my comments that I'm going to make around microgrids and community microgrids. The Clean Coalition is a nonprofit. Yeah.
Hey, Craig, this is Rick. Could you also make – are you going to talk about the legislation that was introduced last week, the community resiliency and the school resiliency stuff? Are you going to include that in – because if you aren't, I can do a minute on that.
I would love for you to do that, Rick. I'm sorry to say that I'm not up on it personally.
Okay.
So
I think
there's people from my team that are tracking all the legislative stuff. But yeah, that would be great to get an update from you, Rick, on that.
Okay, sounds good.
I'll let you follow my comments though, if you wouldn't mind. I'm going to be talking about work that we are doing with the Santa Barbara Unified School District in the context of my comments, and I think your discussion around that policy opportunity will fit in beautifully, as a follow-on. So the Clean Coalition, we're a nonprofit organization. Our mission in life is to accelerate the transition to renewable energy and a modern grid. Our ultimate vision is that we can get to 100% renewable energy. That's going to take a decade or two, or if the Clean Coalition is not successful hitting our mission, 3 decades. But within 30 years, I do believe we will be a virtually 100% renewable energy-driven economy. And when we get there, we believe that at least 25% of the energy mix needs to come from local renewables. And local is really important because when you have local renewables, you get a trifecta of unparalleled benefits to communities in the form of economic, environmental, and resilience. So resilience is a really big driver for the Clean Coalition, and therefore a lot of what the Clean Coalition works on is around microgrids, renewables-driven microgrids, and renewables-driven community microgrids. And just to map Baird's commentary with mine, I think we both talk about microgrids as being behind the meter, aggregation of assets that work together, coordinate together to provide things like resilience. In the case of the Clean Coalition, we're very much about making sure that those microgrids are renewables driven, mostly solar driven, because the ability to put wind turbines and geothermal generators and other things into behind the meter situations are pretty rare. It's going to be mostly solar. Community microgrids map to Baird's comments. I believe he called them hybrid microgrids. Clean Coalition's been using this term community microgrid for a long time. Community microgrids are where you're talking about grid areas. So the grid area would comprise a block of homes and businesses that are on the same feeder. They have to be electrically connected. Community microgrids do need to be electrically connected. They could be across an entire feeder, and they could be across an entire substation. So for those of you who are not super familiar with the way that the grid is actually designed, you have electrical substations, and out of that substations, you generally have a handful of electrical feeders. These are when you see power poles running down a street, that's part of a feeder. And ultimately that feeder started at some substation and goes all the way to the end of the feeder. So community microgrids are microgrids that extend across grid areas that are electrically connected either along a feeder or on multiple feeders that are connected through a substation. And the, with community microgrids, they can be comprised of a whole bunch of microgrids, which are behind-the-meter assets, and they can also include a whole bunch of front-of-meter assets, solar and storage, et cetera. A couple of the example projects that the Clean Coalition is either leading the charge on or is directly involved in are the Redwood Coast Airport microgrid. This is a community microgrid that includes both front of meter and behind the meter assets, solar and storage, and electric vehicle charging infrastructure that is based up in Humboldt, which is at the airport there that serves that community, the municipal airport that serves that community. Now, the feeder that I'm talking about, the feeder segment that I'm talking about, is the last quarter mile or so of an electrical feeder. It has 20 customers on it, including the airport, including Coast Guard facility. Both of those would be considered critical community facilities. And then there's 18 additional customers that are commercial in nature, and none of the additional 18 would be considered critical community facilities. This project will, as I said, have a whole bunch of front of meter assets and a whole bunch of front of meter and behind the meter solar storage and electric vehicle charging infrastructure. The one of the really important elements of the Redwood Coast Airport microgrid, which goes by the acronym RECAM, R-C-A-M, is that it will be working through a whole bunch of the policy and market mechanism considerations that are needed for, you know, much broader proliferation of community microgrids. And these kind of considerations are things like, okay, we have two critical community facilities out of 20 customers in this community microgrid. Those two critical community facilities, one could argue, provide benefits to the entire community and to everybody, right? The Coast Guard serves, you know, everybody in the country, right? Protects our border, protects our maritime borders. Those two critical community facilities, one could argue that the utility should be able to deploy a bunch of front of meter assets there, do upgrades to the distribution grid, like putting grid isolation switches in place, and rate base those costs, right? And all ratepayers would then share in then paying for community microgrids that protect and provide resilience to our critical community facilities that serve broad communities. The other 18 customers in the RECAM, right, they're basically free riders because they're going to be kept on and provided with far more resilience than a typical utility customer would be provided. But that's not something that's likely going to be proliferated, right? We need to figure out how those folks would raise their hand and say, yes, I want to have this, I want to benefit from indefinite renewables driven backup power. And for somebody to do that for me, right, that I just, my meter's not going to get turned off in a grid outage that everybody else is otherwise going to get turned off. And I'm willing to pay more, right? I'm willing to switch over to a rate tariff that I pay a small premium for that added level of resilience. That those tariffs need to be designed. How people participate in them needs to be figured out. And then the customers that choose not to participate, you know, then we need policies and market mechanisms that allow those customers to be turned off when there's a grid outage. The reason they need to be turned off is that if you are running low on energy, if, you know, solar will produce every day, even if it's rainy and stormy, right? If you can see outside, you're producing some level of solar. But if you get to the point where you're going to risk the ability to keep your airport and your Coast Guard station on, you are going to turn those non-paying customers off, right, that are not critical community facilities. So those are the types of considerations that need to be worked through here. I'll mention a couple other quick things. The Clean Coalition is leading a really significant, the most comprehensive community microgrid in the country, probably in the world, in the Santa Barbara region. It's called the Goleta Load Pocket Community Microgrid. The reason it's called the Goleta Load Pocket is that the entire Santa Barbara region, 70 miles of coastal California, with the major cities of Goleta, Santa Barbara, and Carpinteria being the major load centers there, is all served by a single point of interconnection of the transmission system, where the vast majority of energy that serves the Santa Barbara region comes from. And that transmission path is 40 miles long, comes up through the back of the mountains, right through the middle of fire risk, landslide risk, earthquake risk. So the Santa Barbara region is basically screwed if that transmission system goes down. And the Clean Coalition has this initiative called the Goleta Load Pocket Community Microgrid. It's named after the substation, the only transmission and distribution substation that serves the region is called the Goleta Substation. And therefore, this region is called the Goleta Load Pocket. All the electrical load is basically comes through the Goleta Substation. So it's called the Goleta Load Pocket. We've determined that in order to have 100% resilience to that transmission, to a transmission outage, we need, there's two magic numbers. One is 200 megawatts of additional solar, and the other is 400 megawatt hours of energy storage.
even though 400 megawatt hours of energy storage sounds like it's twice as big as 200 megawatts of solar, it's actually going to be really easy to get there. Southern California Edison, which is the utility that serves this portion of Santa Barbara County, it has already applied to the CPUC for 280 megawatt hours of energy storage, which is 70% of 400, for those of you who don't want to do the math. And they've been approved to deploy that 280 megawatt hours as basically buying local capacity services from the third parties that will build on and operate those battery systems. The very first of those, by the way, got a unanimous decision out of the Planning Commission on Wednesday, so 2 days ago, which Clean Coalition was very active in making sure that we got the support for these battery projects. And so the energy storage is going to be easy. All 280 megawatt hours of what I just mentioned needs to be online by about a year from now, by next March. All of that will be online. To get 200 megawatts of solar is going to be a lot harder. So we need to, we've got plenty of opportunity. We know that 200 megawatts of solar in this Goleta load pocket is only 7% of the built environment would have to be hosting solar. So one out of every 15 rooftops, parking lots, parking structures. It's not like putting a man on the moon here. It's totally achievable, but it's going to take time. And one of the reasons it's going to take time is that we don't have policies and market mechanisms that really allow for, you know, wide proliferation of solar deployments, especially if you try to do anything on the front of meter side. I'll mention that within the Goleta load pocket, we've got a couple of really interesting core initiatives. One is in the Montecito region, which in Montecito, most people associate as part of Santa Barbara. It's mostly in the unincorporated area of Santa Barbara, but it's adjacent to the city of Santa Barbara, and most people consider it part of Santa Barbara. And the Montecito was in the news a lot. It got hit with wildfire about a year and a half ago, and then got pummeled with a debris flow, what most people would think of as a landslide or mudslide, and lost 23 lives, lost 10% of the housing stock in its community. It was a serious Armageddon scenario for Santa Barbara region. So we've designed a kind of the first building block of the Goleta Load Pocket Community Microgrid as a smaller community microgrid that basically is targeted at supporting the most critical community facilities in Montecito, which is basically the fire facilities, the water district, which when there's a fire, the water pumps and are going 24/7 to get water up the mountain, where it is then gravity fed to all the fire hydrants and everywhere else that you need water. And then there's a school, the main kind of, you could call it the central school of Montecito. It's an elementary school called Montecito Union. And that school touches everybody in Montecito. Anybody who lives in Montecito either went there, kids go there or went there, or they go to community events there. It's one of these schools that is just central to that community, and everybody has a relationship with it. And it's also on high ground. It's where the fire district already runs their helicopter operations, and where a bunch of emergency response staging is at the school. They've got the equipment and other supplies staged at the school already for dealing with emergencies. And they want to do more. They want to become an emergency shelter and be kind of a place where people can go if they get wiped out of their homes, et cetera. And the last thing I'll mention with the Goleta Load Pocket is Clean Coalition is working with the Santa Barbara Unified School District, which has 21 schools throughout the region, and to do solar microgrids and electric vehicle charging infrastructure at all of those campuses. And these will be full-on solar microgrids that provide economic, environmental, and resilience benefits. And the resilience will keep the most critical loads at all of those schools online forever, right? They will be indefinite solar-driven backup power for those most critical critical loads at those schools. And all of those schools are big. They play major roles in their communities, ultimately as emergency shelters. I'm going to just make a couple quick comments about policy, and then I'll hand it to Rick, who's going to drive something home with respect to similar comments of something that's rolling out here. It sounds like two quick things. One, in order for community solar, Barry mentioned community solar, in order for community solar to provide resilience, which I believe and the Clean Coalition believes is fundamental to anything that's going to have the term community in it, better serve the community. And one of the things I think is really important for everybody to make sure when you have community solar initiatives going on in your regions, make sure that that community renewable deployments need to be in the communities, right? If you're 10 miles away, you're on a completely different substation, there's no way that renewable energy resource is providing any resilience to the community that is paying for it. So if a community is going to pay for a community asset like community solar, the term is thrown around, make sure it is going to be restricted to be deployed in the neighborhoods, in the communities of the people who are going to be paying for it, because then it can be harnessed to provide resilience. And resilience, I think, no matter where you are in the world today, resilience is top of mind. The last thing I'll mention is Pacific and Gas and Electric. As resilience is top of mind, Pacific Gas and Electric and other utilities are kind of using this moment to try to accelerate and just kind of get jammed into place approvals for deploying natural gas-driven microgrids. And PG&E has put a proposal forward to do 20 what they call substation microgrids, which essentially, if you look at the details of the RFP, the only solutions that could be put in place are natural gas peaker plants that are sited at the substations, which is a completely ridiculous way to do it, because when you put the only generating asset at the substation, then your distribution line has to remain intact. And distribution lines are getting shut down all the time with these public safety power shutoffs. Somebody runs into a power pole, everything downline from that down pole is going to be off. Community microgrids are dependent on distributed energy resources, right, which are distributed along the feeder. So even if you have a portion of your feeder that's going to go down, you can keep everything on both sides of that down segment online. This concept of substation microgrids, I think, is a really dangerous one, and one that we all need to band together and make sure that we ensure that the utilities are forced to move forward with true community microgrids, renewables-driven community microgrids, rather than get permission to put in natural gas peaker plants that last for 30, 40, 50 years and will basically force everybody's hand to be paying for these assets that nobody's going to want to be running for any real length of time, and that the renewables can come into place as fast and do a whole lot more than a natural gas peaker plant can do. With that, I'll hand it to Rick.
Wait. I'd like to have Ron Leonard have a chance to talk here before we turn it over to Rick. Yeah,
that's fine. Unfortunately, I have to bolt here in about 5 minutes, so I can
okay.
Follow up with some information.
No.
Later.
If you have to leave, Rick, please go ahead. Yeah. If you have to leave, that's fine. No problem.
I'll be real quick. Three points. I want to segue off of Craig's last point about this PG&E proposal. One of the things that's happening today is that Sonoma Clean Power, the CCA in Sonoma Mendocino County, which is the area where most of these proposals that PG&E is making about putting in these natural gas approaches to quote-unquote community microgrids, Sonoma Clean Power is convening a meeting today of all its local jurisdictions to come up with an alternative. That's a rational alternative to what PG&E is putting forward. So we'll see where that goes. But I want to, echo what Craig says about pushing back hard if you're involved in any kind of California proceeding stuff to get involved in pushing back hard on that model, because it's not a sustainable model. Number two, there's two pieces of legislation that were filed last Friday that are very relevant to this. As both Craig and our previous speaker talked about, the big question is, what are the economics? Who's going to pay for this resilience microgrid capability? So we have two bills that are very important. One is called the Resilient Schools Bill, and it's been introduced by Assembly Member Phil Ting, who is the chair of the Assembly Budget Committee, which is really good. because he's calling for $900 million, $300 million a year over the next 3 years to fund grants and technical assistance to allow schools who are central in, you know, in providing services during grid outages, as Craig alluded to, providing those with grants that would cover the cost of batteries, electrical service upgrades, and microgrid controllers, and in some cases where the school doesn't currently have solar, solar as a generation source, for up to what we hope is 1,000 schools over the next 3 years. This could be a very important set of resources that could be connected in through community microgrids. And the key here is the money, because, you know, in many parts of California, while batteries have economic benefit, there are many parts, particularly in PG&E territory, which represents, you know, almost half of the state. Solar was put into schools under a tariff that eliminates demand charges, which is the primary way in which batteries generate economics. So without those economics, those schools would not put in batteries, but with these grants, they will be able to do that. So that's one important. The second one is a bill introduced or sponsored by the Climate Center, previously known as the Center for Climate Protection, authored by Senator Nancy Skinner, who's a real hero around clean energy issues for many California. And that bill would provide...
One second. Somebody has their phone unmuted, and it's causing a lot of background noise. So would you want to, everybody, just check to make sure your phones are actually muted? Thank you.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I'll be wrapping up here. That bill, that's not the Skinner bill. I'm sorry, it's Senator Bill Dodd, who is represents part of the Sonoma area. Dodd is authoring a bill called the Community Energy Resiliency Act of 2020, SB 1314, which would provide grants to local governments to put together community resiliency plans to be able to basically get them in front of this issue and come up with a way in which they're going to provide local resources and local approaches to provide clean energy resilience. So if anybody's in California and interested, that would be SB 1314. And the Ting bill for resilience for schools is AB 3021. There'll be a press conference a week from this next 2 weeks from today, launching that project or that legislation. So, and if anybody has other, you know, is interested in getting involved, they can also contact me. Sierra has my contact info, and I'll leave it at that. I'm sorry, guys. I have to bail out.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Rick. Thanks for taking the time to come. So Rick, go ahead.
Rick, that was awesome. Thank you very much for that update. And, obviously consider the Clean Coalition partners in both those things. So thanks for making sure I was aware of them.
Sounds good.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Hey, this is Bob Perry. Bob Perry, can I just add one more bill that should be considered quickly?
No, not right, Bob, not right now. We have
okay.
to move forward
right.
with Ron Leonard. He hasn't had a chance to talk yet. So let's,
right.
we'll bring that up at the end then, or on another
okay.
call, whatever. We'll
sure.
have more than one call on this topic for sure. Ron, do you want to talk a little bit about what's going on in Puerto Rico? Are you there?
You have to unmute me, Sierra.
No, you're unmuted. I can hear
okay,
you.
Good.
No, you're unmuted.
Sounds great. Just wanted to go over what I saw the last 2 weeks in Puerto Rico, which is an interesting situation for lots of different reasons, one being that the utility itself is $9 billion in debt. It has been hit, obviously, 2.5 years ago with billions of dollars worth of devastation in hurricanes. Recently, the earthquakes that started out at 6.4 caused 5,397 claims for devastation in housing. And one of the small power plants, which is one-fifth the entire power of Puerto Rico, was destroyed in this process. So they are reeling with a utility system that was starting out to be dysfunctional. The power plant that was destroyed is 60 years old. You can get an idea of the entire age of the utility, a bankrupt utility, and now it is limping along with all power plants running at maximum force and basically unfunctional in terms of its design. So now the commission that is in charge of reforming the utility has taken testimony on the 11th of the month, which I participated in, trying to convert this dysfunctional utility into a 100% renewable utility. And one of the proposals in this process is 12 microgrids. The issue with the microgrids are twofold. One, the entity that proposed changing to PREPA, which is the name of the utility, is Siemens, and a lot of their recommendations have to do with, unfortunately, like the Clean Coalition talked about, putting in natural gas infrastructure and powering lots of things with that, possibly even including microgrids. That probably does not work for lots of reasons, one being infrastructure in an area that's now being hit by earthquakes is not such a good idea when you're putting natural gas pipelines in the ground. Another is the cost of this new infrastructure would basically indebt the people of Puerto Rico for the next three generations and never pay off the billions of dollars in dysfunctional debt that the utility incurred. So the microgrid situation is very interesting only because what we're seeing in the map, at least layout of proposed microgrids, is they're not being used just to provide power to critical infrastructure. They're actually being laid out in such a way that it looks like it's stitching the grid together. And the grid has critical paths. Most of the power is being produced in the south of the island. Most of the energy use is in the north of the island, San Juan. And this path of electricity use is across the mountain range and all the poles that went across the mountain range. The last time in the hurricane were destroyed. So now we have this series of proposed microgrids, which in one sense are a needed reform, but in another sense are being used to very likely create a power system that really didn't exist before and really is not functional today. And the microgrids may or may not solve the proposed solution very well. So what we're seeing in this reform process is the utility struggling and asking questions at the meeting. The Federal Reform Commission anyway is asking questions at the meeting is, how much solar should we have? How much wind should we have? How much natural gas should we have? Where should we put it? What are the costs? And no one is really providing them with answers to those basic questions. One of the things that we testified to was the work by our friend Dr. Richard Perez and Mark Perez's son on having a way to justifiably do 100% renewable energy as baseload power and do it economically. And some of the research that they've done proves that both on mainland states and now on an island that they've analyzed, and we think that data will be directly transposed to a place like Puerto Rico. So what we're saying is two things. One is microgrids are fine, but we really still need a grid system that's functional. Two, that 100% renewable energy is possible and it's faster and cheaper to do. And three, what is the purpose of building out the grid with a system that may or may not serve the population for long periods of time? Because if we end up putting large solar farms or large wind farms or other commercial size projects in various places in the island, a grid still has to be a functional grid. And we need to do a real reform rather than a piecemeal reform.
All right. So, Bob, what I'd like to do is, if you can talk about the laws just briefly, and then we only have a few more minutes left, but it has to be pretty quick, and then we'll open it up to discussion.
Yeah, no, I'll be really quick. Rick described those two bills. There's one more bill, SB 1240, which would basically require the CEC and in collaboration with the CAISO, the California Independent System Operator, to investigate developing what would be known as an open access distribution system. And this type of distribution system would incentivize utilities to facilitate local energy development and would provide the revenue stream for them to be a distribution system operator. So this works in tandem with the other two bills. I think it's another important part of the puzzle. And that's it for me.
All right. Yeah. So anybody have any comments or questions about the discussion so far? I'm sure somebody does. It's okay, Craig. You can talk. Or Baird.
This area. I just wanted to, there's one other bill. Senator Stern has introduced a bill that would both provide funding for community microgrids and require what we've been suggesting to the PUC, that it's the Office of Emergency Services who already is involved in doing, you know, planning with all the communities for emergency response, who should be working with communities to determine what's a critical facility on a uniform basis across the state. And then once you've done that, it naturally follows that the utilities should provide literally open access, that the cost of making it possible to have those community microgrids and, you know, shouldn't be allocated on the last microgrid in pays for the upgrade, but it should be, this is for everybody in the state, and we'll determine what's needed across the state, and then we'll fund that on a collective basis.
And I'll add on to Baird's comments that all of these bills and policy actions that have been discussed today are really critical, and they tie together. I agree with Baird. I think this SB 1240 that Robert Perry just mentioned, I'll call it the DSO bill. The formation of distribution system operators is really important. I do want to come back to what Ron was talking about with the threat of natural gas and what I also talked about earlier with PG&E's RFP for 20 natural gas peaker plants, to form so-called substation microgrids. This approach that the utilities are taking is basically would preempt any real objectives that the rest of us are talking about today, right? That we want to have renewables-driven community microgrids. And if you put a big old natural gas peaker plant in somewhere, you have eliminated the opportunity. You have sucked out the oxygen for anybody having the appetite to put additional costs onto ratepayers for the kind of, grid upgrades and other deployments that are required for renewables-driven community microgrids. By the way, at a much cheaper cost and with much higher, superior functionality, right? The renewables-driven community microgrids can do way more than the natural gas peakers, including provisioning resilience. So I just want to, offer that the Clean Coalition has been we've put together quite a lot of collateral material around the dangers of natural gas and the fact that it is not a resilience solution. And Ron and anybody else, I gave a webinar back in July last year, so about six months ago. That's on the Clean Coalition website, and it's basically about the Goleta Load Pocket Community Microgrid. There's a whole bunch of information that I go through in that webinar on the dangers of natural gas, and I talk through it, and then we've got a bunch of slide material in the slides. You can spend an hour and hear me present all the information, or you can just download the presentation in PowerPoint form if you just want to borrow the collateral material.
But I will say, we've been very successful working, Clean Coast has been very successful working in partnership with groups like the World Business Academy, one of the groups that Robert Perry works with, in preempting the ability for natural gas peaker plants to get built in California and also to get repowered in California. So in the Goleta load pocket, there is a natural gas peaker plant that is required to go offline within a couple of years from right now. And Southern California Edison tried hard to get that repowered, meaning it would be refurbished and would have a lifetime of 10, 20, 30 additional years. And actually, like 20, 30, 40, 50 additional years. And the Clean Coalition and World Business Academy, Sierra Club, a whole bunch of parties came together, and the Clean Coalition in particular brought the technical analysis and economic analysis to show that a community microgrid, renewables-driven community microgrid approach is far superior for the community on economic, environmental, and resilience benefits on all three of those levels, and we were successful. We want to obviously take that those successes and help leverage them everywhere else around the country, including Puerto Rico, which is a U.S. territory.
Okay, I'd like to open this up to anybody who has not had a chance to talk yet. Any questions? Anybody?
This is Bob Perry. I just want to give one shameless plug here. On May 18th, there's going to be a Community Energy Resilience Summit hosted by the Climate Center, and one of the sponsors is the Clean Coalition. It's going to focus on this very issue, and that's May 18th up in Sacramento. So if you're interested, go to the Climate Center website.
Okay. Anybody else here? Go ahead.
It's Ron. I should add that there was an interesting quote from a guy who is president and CEO of the Ontario Power Generation Group, and he said basically, we get approached a lot about buying gas plants in the U.S. I wouldn't touch one. In a lot of these jurisdictions, it's the next coal, and I think it's coming quicker than we think. I want to emphasize that basically when you hear utilities trying to push more natural gas, that's another stranded asset, and that stranded asset is being proposed by Doug. And, of course, we all know who Doug is, dumb old utility guys.
Love it. We need to get rid of the Doug, man. We need the Dougs to retire.
Doug. No bugs and no Dougs.
About 6 minutes left here. Anybody else? Well, I'm sure this isn't the last conversation we'll ever have. Barry, do you have any comment on all this?
No, I'll pass.
That goes down as a first. So,
hey, Barrett, I'll take advantage of this opportunity to just ask you a question. There's a lot of stuff happening in Australia to deploy solutions that allow for, very significant penetration levels of solar that go way beyond what the kind of the old 15% rule and all the things that I think Hawaii's going through. And I think Hawaii is probably a couple of years behind Australia. And Australia actually has higher penetration levels of solar than Hawaii by like double, at least certain portions of Australia. Would you be interested in talking to one of the key solution providers that's working, that's doing these things down in Australia, and just seeing how you might be able to work with them to get their solutions highlighted in Hawaii to help Hawaii understand how to move forward in the most effective way?
Well, I'd be interested on general principle. The Hawaii thing is pretty far along. They're going to have a draft tariff in another month and formally submitted. The working group process is basically ended, although we're probably going to have one more meeting this week. But then there'll be a comment period and anybody can raise things, but it's pretty cooked. And I think what it is just open technology, and I think we're going to have a requirement that microgrids, meet the state goals, which is basically to be 100% renewable by 2040. So I think that's doing pretty well, actually. But as I said, I'd be more than interested in talking to the people in Australia. I don't. Audrey Zibelman's an old friend, so I'd be. I haven't kept up with what's going on.
Cool.
And I put the plug in for the pioneering work again done by Dr. Richie Perez and his son on how 100% renewable energy actually does work. It's a peer-reviewed scientific study, and I think that type of evidence should be put forward to lots of regulators. Basically, with the Rocky Mountain Institute in September found that 70% of projected plant buildouts, natural gas, will be rendered uneconomic by 2035 as low-cost renewable energy and demand response plus energy efficiency undercut all those stranded asset investments. So we really should put our money not only where our mouth is, 100% renewable energy, but we should put our money where it makes sense so that we don't burden ratepayers with unending debt for the next 50 years.
Do you have those materials that you can share with Sierra and she can pass them?
I certainly will do that.
Yeah, that would be great if you could do that. About 1 minute. Anybody else? Okay. Well, this won't be the last conversation we have on this topic. So anyhow, thanks so much for everybody for coming. And we had some excellent presenters and really good information today. And hope to see you all next time. We've got a webinar coming up next week on the 3rd. And Jeff Hinsky is going to be talking on the webinar.
Yep.
And so be sure to tune in on that, and the invitations on that too. So anyhow, thanks so much for everybody for coming, and we'll see you all next time. We have a couple conference calls coming up as well, now that I mentioned it, March, early March, on
thank
the 3rd.
This is Jeff. You said I think the webinar is on the 3rd. I think it's actually the 4th.
No, the conference call is on the 3rd. The economics and feasibility of adding storage to municipal projects, two different times. The 3rd is a conference call, and on the 4th he's going to be talking about that topic as a webinar. And then next Monday, March 9th, we're looking at educational institutions working on community energy programs. So we'll have a few folks on that one. Should be interesting. John Motlock will be involved in that. He's worked with Ball State University, done some really tremendous work working with communities on energy projects. So anyhow, thanks for coming, everybody, and we'll see you next week, hopefully, on the conference calls. All right. Talk to you soon.
Right. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Sherry, was that you? Yeah. All right.
Thank you, Sierra. And I'd be interested in the information from the other gentlemen.
Yes, anybody that wants me to send out anything, just send it to me to sierra@msecforum.com. I'd be happy to distribute it. And what was this now, Baird? Is that you?
I was only saying thank you and goodbye.
Oh, okay. I thought there was something more there.
It was the information from the Perez. It was referred to as Perez's son, research about the 100% renewables.
Okay. All right. Well, send it to me, and I'll forward it to everybody, along with the recordings for the last couple of conference calls. All right. Talk to you then.
Bye.